I'll introduce you. This is Jerry Odell, and I'm talking today with Sarath Janga, assistant professor in bioinformatics. And why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your research?
Hi, this is Sarath Janga from the School of Informatics and Computing. I'm an assistant professor in bioinformatics in the Department of Biohealth Informatics. And my lab is into systems biology and genomics, broadly speaking. And specifically, we are looking at a number of next-generation sequencing data sets. And sequencing is very big in the clinical world these days because you can genotype for patients to find out what kind of mutations are actually occurring in a patient. And for instance, in cancers, we know that most diseases are caused, forms of cancer are because of mutations. And we mine such data, and these data sets, for instance, for a given patient or a given person, the data sets could be anywhere between 20 to 100 gigs.
Wow.
And these are compressed files.
Okay.
So we are talking about huge amounts of data. And IU, fortunately, Indiana University is one of the institutions where we have the luxury of free and, a lot of compute power,
right.
And it's possible to mine such data sets. We are talking, for instance, in one of the consortium projects, which is providing data for analysis, it's called the Cancer Genome Atlas. There are about 10,000 patients,
mm-hmm.
and you can scale the different dimensions of data mm-hmm. that is available, and it's only possible. It's in infrastructure like BigRed and Mason and mm-hmm. Now CARS systems. Yeah, we do mine that on a mm-hmm. day-to-day basis. And we find what are the changes or mutations or alterations happening in a cancer patient. We try to find the network of protein interactions
mm-hmm.
to potentially say that this is the molecule which is actually altered. So our research revolves around trying to find how proteins talk to each other in a cell,
mm-hmm.
in specific tissues, like which are the disease that you're interested in, and in the context of multidimensional data. And this multidimensional data, when I say this, this is coming from a lot of different wet labs, experimental
yeah.
labs. We integrate that, and we yeah. do data mining. So that's a short overview of some of the things that we do in the lab.
Yeah.
And we can translate to any number of diseases. The ideas are pretty much similar, whether it's a liver disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, cancer, glioblastoma, breast cancer, and so on.
Right. So that sounds like a lot of data to store and manage and keep track of.
Absolutely.
That's, yeah. And tell me about the, now we're sort of going off script, but what's the goal of this research? Like, where is it going to land in the real world someday? What kind of difference is it going to make?
So just to give you, I think I'll put it more from a specific examples. Recently, we found that in non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, there are some genes which are actually changing in obese patients, and obesity is on the rise in U.S. and a lot of other countries as well. And in the past, most of the obesity-driven liver disorders have been poorly studied. And now we know that among many things that obesity causes, it also can damage liver. And so we found that some proteins like SRSF, which is a group of proteins, they are actually altered in
mm-hmm.
Liver diseases, in obesity-associated liver diseases. And we have collaborated with an investigator in Urbana-Champaign who has actually shown that in mouse with liver diseases, this
mm-hmm.
protein is actually altered. And this is a prediction
mm-hmm.
that we actually found based used on using data. And later on, he showed
yeah.
it in mouse model that is actually true. And we are now collaborating for more extensively to see how does it actually do that. So that's an example of one
yeah.
particular, So data mining actually narrows down the potential hits which can help you to do focused experiments. And
right.
that's something that is done in my lab or other
right.
computational labs on a day-to-day basis. So we study, for instance, this liver diseases. We have been also focusing on cancers. We collaborate with breast cancer researchers here in the Simon Cancer Center. And there are different, again, types of breast cancer. Again, depending on the type of mutations. So we focus on triple negative and those cancer. And we routinely look at clinical sequencing data. When patients come, sequencing data appears, and we are we're happy to say that we have the luxury of accessing direct clinical data after IRB and all those. You know, So yeah, so that's the direction, broadly speaking, some of the directions that my lab is going. We also focus on a specific kind of regulation. It's called post-transcriptional, where RNA is actually regulated. In the past, most of the work in the cancer literature has been on looking at signaling molecules like PI3 kinase and so on, or transcription factors like P53. Mm-hmm. But now people appreciate that non-coding RNAs are also important. Mm-hmm. And that's the layer that we are more and more. And for instance, the SRSF protein that I was talking, it's a splicing factor. It does affect the splicing in the cell.
Yeah.
So
nice. Sounds like you have to involve research partners from
many
places and many departments on
campus.
And
as more and more things become translational, yes, that's becoming a norm for a lot of computational investigators.
Yeah. So you made an effort to make a lot of your articles about your research projects open access, so anyone in the world can read them without a subscription. And I wanted to know, you know, why you made that effort and what you thought was the value of doing that.
Okay, let me start with, 10 years ago, if you had asked me this question, I would have probably said there's not so much interest even among either the publishers or among the people. But in the past 5-10 years, both funding agencies as well as universities across US and even outside have been campaigning, and even publishing groups have been actually pushing this idea of open access publishing. In the first, I'm sure you and a lot of others like me as well have been probably skeptical about this model. And now I think it's pretty obvious that making things available freely in public domain makes it accessible to any age group or any kind of people. They don't have to be scientists. Because a lot of the time, you want the science to be available to general public as well, not necessarily only to the scientists. And I think that's a great move, and which increases not only visibility of the work, or not only to the scientists and students, even in developing countries and everywhere, but also makes general public aware of where are the tax dollars actually going.
Yeah.
And this gives the decision right into the hands of the people how these new discoveries, translational scientific discoveries, which are important and helping the human health, or actually, you know, where is the money actually going?
Right.
And I think all these are also revolutionizing the idea and pushing more and more these publishing groups, including Nature. Nature has promised to move a lot of its journals, including Nature Communications.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to talk about what others are doing. And all this is pushing everybody. And we are always excited to make our software, our publications, everything in the public domain. And this is what I've been doing right when I was a PhD student. And most of my papers always appeared in open access journals. So I'm not at all surprised to be campaigning for something like this.
So
for all these
even
reasons,
when you were a grad student?
Absolutely. So I think at least 70% of my papers are in open access journals.
Wow.
Another 30% partly because of collaborations and YouTube channels and other reasons, they might have ended up in non-open access.
Right, you have to go with your co-authors sometimes.
Exactly.
Right. So the library supports a policy the campus recently adopted, and the policy says faculty will share a version of their article in the institutional repository. We call it ScholarWorks. So, and that's one way the library supports open access on campus. And another way is that we have a small publishing fund, and we support faculty authors who are doing research and may not have the grant funds to support the article processing fees that some journals like PLOS ONE or Biomed Central require. And I wondered if you'd used either of those services and how they've been a help to you.
I've always been a strong supporter, and I've also been fortunate to get the help from IUPUI's library fund. And as a starting investigator, it has been really, really helpful for getting my first set of papers, because any new investigator is always is hungry for support.
Right.
And I'm no different. And I think in such need, the library fund has been pretty useful. As far as I recall, the Library Fund has helped me publish at least a few, 3 to 4, 5 mm-hmm. papers from my lab. And all those papers are actually much more accessed than any of the those other papers which I have published in the past in the non-open access journals.
Right.
And I think that's a great move from the university library using these funds to help people who don't have funds, or NIH funded, or currently or funding to support such publications.
Or they may have run out of, or their grant may have just run dry, which
absolutely
happens.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the other aspect is more and more journals are actually dependent on collecting the publication fees from the authors as opposed to making them non-open access model, mm-hmm. and it is actually becoming a big wave. And in that direction, I would like to add some comments that that model is very good in general. However, it also pushes that how a university community or university as such should be building resources to support
true.
Publication of theses, not necessarily
yeah.
publication of journals, but also can you actually have databases of the theses for searchable theses so
yeah.
that not only students from the same university or faculty from mm-hmm. the same university, but even people outside
mm-hmm.
can access, perhaps, you know, in an open access manner. And
mm-hmm.
funds should be allocated to such kind of. And I have several, I've faced several instances where people are asking thesis copies of master's and PhD students from
right.
our school or from our university. And you always are, you know, what's the best way? You know, should
right,
we share
right.
it through? And I'm very supportive about some of the things that IUPUI Scholar Works is actually doing towards
mm-hmm.
promoting the inclusion of these thesis copies so in a searchable way. And
right.
I think that's the right way to go.
That's great. You know, now it's my turn to say the way you've helped us. Actually, for a while, our institutional repository Scholar Works, we really had only two access options. You could embargo the dissertation or any other work you submitted, or you could make it freely available. And then the embargo would expire after a while. And then we had a conversation, I think it was maybe a year or two ago, and as a result, we now have a request feature so that if we have a good student in informatics writes a good thesis, but they're not ready to share it right away, maybe they want to get some articles published
mm-hmm.
first or something like that, there's a request button. And if they hit that button, an automated email is generated. The grad student gets an email saying, hey, someone would like to read your dissertation, and would you grant them permission? All they have to do is click yes to grant permission. And that works not just on the IU campus, but all around the world. And that's a feature we added because of a conversation you and I had. So this is a two-way street, and it's been
absolutely
great to work
fantastic.
With you.
I haven't had a chance to explore the feature, but
yeah.
I think my students would love to see such feature because, again, depending on the state of a thesis defense or a publication of a paper, and often students are very protective about
right.
their research work
right.
and they don't want to make it public soon enough, but they do want to make it public with time. So having such kind of options or
right.
flexibility in the system would be fantastic.
Well, it wouldn't be there if it hadn't been a conversation we had 18 months ago.
Thank you.
So I'll have to send you a link so you can see how
no,
it
yeah,
works.
I think that'd be
yeah.
great. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Thanks for talking with me, Sarah. This is
thank you.
Always fun.
Yeah.